You're listening to this week's episode of Macquarie Street Matters, a podcast about the personalities and events in the New South Wales Parliament here in Sydney with Alistair Hinskins. My very special guest is my good friend, Upper House MP, Deputy Leader of the National Party, Bronnie Taylor, who I like to call Bron Bron. Welcome to Macquarie Street Matters.
Thank you, Alpha. Thank you for letting me be here as a National Party member too. I'm very chuffed about it.
Well, you're trailbreaking. You are the first Nat. Well, you're the first non-Lib that we've had on the podcast. So okay. I'll just let that speak for itself.
That's kind of up there with being the first Deputy Leader as a female in 100 years with the Nats. I'm going to say up there on the podcast is, you know.
Nice segue. Yeah. Nice segue. I didn't even have to ask you about that. Very, very good. Now, Bronnie, we can talk politics in a minute, but I want to talk a little bit about you. You've had what is in some respects an unusual, but in some respects more normal than many people would think, road to living in regional New South Wales, because you lived all over the world. You spent time when you were growing up in New York and then in Southeast Asia. And your father worked for Qantas, and there's even from time to time I can pick up your slight American twang from all that time overseas as a young girl. Mm. What was that like?
It was amazing. And it's funny because I really didn't know anything else, right? So that was sort of how I grew up. And I guess learning to speak in New York sort of like gave you that. That's how I've learned to speak. So it's actually a conscious effort, I think, to become more Australian. And those were the days when everyone loved Qantas. So that sort of was easier, unlike now.
Where did you live in New York?
In Manhattan. In Manhattan.
New York. Yeah,
exactly. So poor old mum, you know, she was pretty hard having two children under five in an apartment in New York on the, you know, whatever floor it was. But
that would have been cool. Were you near Central Park?
Yeah, near Central Park. And
used to go to the zoo.
And mum would take me to the park. And yeah, it was great. Macy's. That's right.
What else do you remember of that time in New York?
I remember having to get rugged up all the time. I remember it being really cold. I remember lots of times with, you know, my parents and doing really fun things. I remember really apartment living, you know. Mum and Dad were always friends with people above and sort of below floors. We were always at each other's places and things. So it was fun. But I remember being inside all the time, whereas then when we moved to the Philippines, I remember being outside and having a very sort of different life to the one that we had. But you know, it was an amazing time, and my father was a really funny person, and so he used to have these amazing sort of Australian parties, and he'd put a boat in the swimming pool, and he'd, you know, do all those things, and he always flew an Australian flag, like when we lived in the Philippines and in Bangkok, so, you know, really aware of who we are and where we're from. But yeah, I had a really great childhood.
So in Southeast Asia, when you lived there, what was that like, and what are your memories of that?
Yeah, well, so I went to the international school, so that was fun. Al was co-ed, and it was exciting, and there were people from all over the world, and you know, get to do heaps of stuff with the Americans, but yet you're also very connected, you know, naturally, culturally. I love Asia. I feel very connected to it and its way of life and its people, and I loved that. I loved that, you know, after school you'd go and, you know, get noodles in a plastic bag from the noodle man that sort of would walk up and down. And I loved the relationships, and I love the people. The Filipinos are particularly just an amazing people, and their, you know, their command of the English language is so powerful. So language isn't a barrier there. I remember going to church. My father was Catholic. My mum was Anglican. So it was quite a, you know, hoo-ha in their day. Mm. But we were never aware of that growing up. So some Sundays you'd go with mum, some you'd go with dad. And that was amazing, living in such a Catholic country. Mm. And then Thailand was incredible, again, with the religion and Buddhism and learning all of that. And just their whole culture is so different because they were never colonised. So, you know, they're quite a sort of proud, sort of stoic people and very militarised. So, but I mean, you know, I lived through the Marcos coup. You know, my father was on his bicycle going through the streets when there were huge protests. And so my interest in politics was there, but it was just very different because it wasn't Australian politics.
And after that coup in Thailand, did you come, in the Philippines, is that when you went to Thailand?
No, we stayed there. Dad was always in it.
okay.
So, yeah, we were sort of there and, you know, you just had to be careful. And Qantas was very specific about its security advice and, you know, what you had to do and everything. And we had, you know, we lived with guards on our front gates and things like that. Yeah. So, yeah. But that was kind of normal, Al, because I'd never lived in Australia, so I really didn't know a lot different.
Yep. And so you then, I think at some stage, maybe it was year seven or later on, you came to live back in Australia at a boarding school.
In the mighty electorate of Ku-ring-gai.
In my electorate, yes, in Pymble. And so was that like a massive cultural change?
Massive, massive. So I went in year nine. Qantas used to pay your school fees in those days. And there was a fellow on, because my mother had actually gone to Askham. And so she was thinking that, you know, maybe we'd all sort of go on there. But that was, you know, Pymble was really keen on taking the Qantas kids. I think they felt it as a bit of a way that they could sort of help in letting us in. And oh my gosh, you know, I went from wearing blue mascara and curling my hair with a curling wand every day to an all-girls school with a school uniform. So it was a huge shock.
And the ribbon in your hair.
Oh, well, yeah, that took a while. And oh, and the hats and the badges and the socks. No, thank goodness. But, you know, I just remember things like, you know, when I played baseball when we lived in the Philippines. And so, you know, someone would get up to bat and you'd be on second base. You'd go, you know, hey, batter, like this sort of thing. So I did that at softball, at pinball, when we were playing Abbott's. Like, can you imagine, like, all the parents there going, who is this girl? Like, someone needs to tell her to be quiet.
And a bit of cultural re-education, wasn't
it? Yeah, there was. And because my parents, you know, were overseas, I didn't see them a lot. It wasn't like it is now where we're all very involved in our children's education. I think my parents probably went to PLC probably three times, and that wasn't a bad thing. Like, I didn't think I was, you know, neglected or anything. But look, I loved it. I loved country people, and it was amazing. All the country boarding parents just took you in.
So is that the first time that you really came into contact with people from regional New South Wales when you were at boarding school?
Yes.
And so did you then have friends who lived out in regional areas that you would go and visit on holidays and so on?
Yeah. Oh,
okay, cool.
Yeah, so that's how it all started. And that's how I decided I wanted to marry a country boy.
Right. And so did you decide that before or after you met Duncan?
Oh, I decided before I met him.
Oh, did you?
Okay. He hates it when I tell the story, but I had a joke in the common room one night and I said to all the boarders, I'm going to go to the King's Formal with the Year 12 school captain. And they said, but you don't know him. I said, oh, I've heard he's a really lovely guy. So anyway, I never give up, Al. So,
well, that's very, very well done. So you didn't, it wasn't as if you met in the Oaks at Double Bay or something.
Well, look, we did.
Oh, okay. Oh, now it's coming out.
Yeah, on the train station.
I don't mean to spoil the story.
On the train station on the way to the Oak. But yeah, no, oh, look, Dunk's just a delight. You can't but help. And for me, it was just, I was absolutely smitten at first meeting.
Very nice.
Yeah, no, it's been great.
So
I married the best, Taylor. Am I allowed to say that in a Liberal Party podcast?
I don't know, that's a bit controversial, and of course there's Charlie, but
yeah, <we're...
laughs> who's my friend.
Yeah.
So okay, so then you met Duncan, you finished school, you went to Sydney University and did nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was really a big decision in your life to do nursing, because that's then become an enormous part of your life and some of the experiences that you've had and also been able to bring to Parliament.
Yeah, no, it's great. Great profession. I, you know, say to anyone, if you're remotely interested in healthcare, it's a wonderful job. You can work anywhere, do anything, and it teaches you a lot, you know, because I'm surrounded by lawyers in Parliament.
Well, there's one or two. I wouldn't say surrounded.
But, you know, it's interesting, like, we're trained to observe and we're trained to solve a problem, because if it's a grotty wound or it's... And it's amazing how transferable a lot of those skills are.
But. And very practical profession too.
Yeah, it's a great profession. It's such a great job. Mm.
And so, what, in your 20s you went down and lived in Nimitabelle, or was there something that was in between Sydney University and...
Yeah, no one. And, you know, I travelled, I went to Africa and did that for a while. Duncan also sort of travelled overseas. And then he was a lawyer at the time at Minters. And I thought, happy days, you know, we're going to stay in Sydney. My parents had just moved back to Australia. You know, I was pretty sure at that stage I was going to end up with Dunk. And then Dunk sort of announced that he really wanted to go back and be a farmer. And I thought, oh, no. So, but we did, and it was the best thing that we ever did. Mm. And I don't think Minters actually believed him, because they kept his name on the letterhead for years because they thought surely he would come back. But it was honestly the best thing we did, and it was wonderful for me. I worked at Coomer Hospital, and it just, you know, drove my passion in healthcare. And then I realised about all those inequities that existed between my city patients and my country patients, and so it just motivated me to get sort of quite, advocate and quite active.
So when was it? Was it because you'd worked as a nurse in the city and then went back to the country, or was that inequity something that you were sort of aware of continually through the time that you worked as a nurse?
No, you learn about it, but you don't. I'm one of those people who have to see things. Mm. So it was definitely only when I went back.
Right, okay. And so when you're at Coomer Hospital and so on, you could see. After you had your children and so on, you then got into cancer nursing with the McGrath Foundation, or is there a step that I've left out?
No, that's right. Yeah, so I'd done cancer nursing in Sydney. It was really what sparked my passion and community-based care. And it was really interesting, actually, the time when I did my prac for community nursing, Duncan's mum was dying back in Nimitabelle, and he was 20 at the time, and we would talk all the time, and I'd say, this is what I think I really want to do, Dunk, community nursing. And he said, oh, funny you should say that, because this amazing woman, Mary Walters, has just come to look after mum, and because she died at home, which was really not what was happening sort of at that time, and Duncan's dad was just amazing. And then I ended up working with Mary, who was Duncan's mum's community nurse, when I moved back. So I think I had all of those connections and that desire to do that. And then the job with the McGrath Foundation came up, and so I applied for that, and I just sort of started sort of broadening my scope in terms of, that's the thing about the country too, is you have amazing opportunities for career progression. So, I mean, I was a clinical nurse consultant way before I would have been in the city, I think. So there were all of those opportunities, yep. and that's what I did, and I loved it. And then we lobbied for a local oncology service, and that sort of happened. So that got me involved, and because it's a bellwether seat, that's how I sort of got a bit interested in politics, because there was an election at the time, so we were trying to play off both sides to get the funding, and that's how it all started.
Okay, interesting. And what about your broader integration into regional life? Is there something that you want to say about that?
It was hard.
Yeah.
Like, I love people, Al. Yeah. And so being out on a sort of property is like quite foreign to me. So, you know, after I had like Hannah, my eldest daughter, I just used to drive into town every day just to walk up and down the street, you know, so I could sort of see people. And so that was, you know, difficult. But now I can't imagine it any other way. So I think country people really wrap you around with lots of love and support.
But you're sort of such a social, vivacious person that I would have thought that would work well into getting involved in a whole lot of things.
Yeah, well, in the country. It did once I worked out sort of how to do that.
Because many people are socially isolated in the cities, even though there's a lot of people around.
True.
Whereas country or regional areas, it seems to me, work harder at, you know, having interaction with people. A lot of people are socially isolated within the city.
Mm.
So I think you just said you needed to work out how to.
Yeah.
How to get socially connected. So what did you do?
Well, I think working was really good for me, because I was never going to be, like, I'm not really very good on the farm, Al. I know that's probably very hard for you to believe, but I'm just not. And Duncan sort of, you know, I think prefers that I have my own career as well that I think was really important for me. And then I think having children is a great leveler too, because you get to meet lots of people through that. So it just sort of, you know, grew and it's a great community down there, you know.
Yeah. And so was it mainly through work, or did you get involved in other things?
It was mainly through work. Yeah. I think work was my real passion and the girls.
Right,
you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
And so just take me through how you develop better cancer services in your local area.
So I was looking after this lady called Susan Mitchell, who was this real stalwart on the Monero, and like she'd been very involved in a lot of Senate estimates. She'd been very involved in agri-politics and very involved in the National Party. She'd run a few times. She'd never sort of won a seat. And she'd been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and so I'd got a referral to go and see her, and I was terrified because she had quite a reputation as a very strong, sort of outspoken sort of woman. And she'd also been, she had been a great mate of Dunk's mum's. They played bridge together. So I walked in there and I ended up looking after her, and I just loved her, and we just hit it off like a house on fire. And she didn't often want to talk about her cancer. Pancreatic cancer is pretty awful, and you know, it was late stage, so she knew she had a very defined sort of time. And she just used to say to me, "You need to get involved in politics. You'd be absolutely fantastic." And I was like, "Well, that's just ridiculous. We're here to talk about, you know, how are your pain levels and what are we doing, and you know, blah blah blah." And then they just kept working on me, and then they got people in the National Party to approach me to think about running for the seat of Monero. Right. So in that election. But unbeknownst to me, the National Party were also talking to John Barilaro. So, you know, and I always joke with John that he got a better membership drive than I did. We he says it's all his cousins.
We call it membership development.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, of course you do. And it was funny because we were like these big adversaries to start with, John and I. And then I sort of thought, look, it's pretty obvious who's got the numbers here, so there's not a lot of point. And then they said, look, we really think you should try for the upper house. But look, I had never said – people often think, I think, because of my last name, that I've been involved in politics for a long time, and I haven't.
I know you haven't. Yeah,
yeah, you know I haven't.
Were you ever on council?
Yes. So
how did that happen?
I lost my first pre-selection.
Right.
So you know when you go around to all your pre-selectors in the party and they say they're going to vote for you and then they don't? Well, that's happened to me.
The only person you're supposed to trust are the ones that say they won't vote
yes.
for you.
Yeah. Well, I was a bit naive. And so I did that and I was absolutely gutted. So John won the seat of Monero and I basically missed out on the upper house seat. And so then that all happened and I thought, oh, forget this. I'm just not interested. This is just ridiculous. You know, how can people tell you they're going to vote for you and they're not vote for you? So then...
That was an early warning.
Oh, no. Anyway, I know. So then what happened was our mayor in Coomer died of cancer, who's actually one of my patients.
Oh, okay.
And they said I should run in the by-election. It's like, I'm not doing local government. You know how you can be a bit of a snob and think I'm not doing local government sort of thing. Anyway, I ended up being convinced to do it. I did really well on the poll and then I did that for about... I think I did a year and then I became the deputy mayor and then the another spot came up for the pre-selection, so I ran again. And that time I actually beat three sitting members for the spot.
And did you come to realise just how important local government is to local communities?
And how much you can do.
You probably hadn't realised that.
I hadn't realised that at all. And I still think it's so important. And it's so that closest level of government to people. And I think it's really important. And I hate seeing now, we had our first time where the Labor Party ran a ticket in Snowy Monero. And we never had tickets up until sort of one election cycle ago, and they've got two members on. And the Nats, we don't do local government politics, the Libs do. But I hate that sort of involvement at that level because I think it should be so much more grassroots. Yep.
Well, having manned a polling booth with you and Kuma
for
a federal by-election, it did seem as if you knew everyone.
Oh, yeah, the community's been really good to me. So, well, it's quite funny, actually, because...
Not only did you know all of them, but you knew how they all voted as well.
I know.
Now, so then you went then... When you nominated for the upper house again from being a councillor, did you stay on... How did that work? How did you manage the local government and upper house once you won your pre-selection?
Yeah, so once I won the pre-selection, I was just really honest about it. I always declared that I'd been a member of the National Party. And then, you know, people don't really care about the upper house, let's be honest. So everyone knew I'd won something, but they didn't sort of know what it was. And then when I went into Parliament, I served out my term on local government until the point that they wouldn't have to have a by-election, which was what I'd committed to. And then I sort of exited out and then, that was that.
And to the next person on your ticket? Then you
no, actually, it wasn't that.
They could just wait until the next election.
Because it's a certain time
before
the next election.
Now, you and I didn't know each other before we both came into Parliament at the same time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we've sort of become friends since. And I realised that you were some relation by marriage to a friend of mine from university. But... One of the things that I've really enjoyed sort of watching how you've been a parliamentarian is the way in which you were so responsive to concerns with regard, particularly when you became a minister. You know, you would always be very good at sort of responding to things and listening to ideas or issues or whatever. So you started off as the Minister for Mental Health, and it really seemed to me that you really made some major... steps forward in what is a really incredibly important area. What are some of the things that you kind of really felt proud of in terms of mental health and what you were able to achieve?
It was amazing. And look, I was really lucky because I kept the portfolio for four years. Because I know when I became the deputy leader, they're like, oh, no, we're going to change all your portfolios and, you know, you'll have senior because it's senior and junior. And I said, no, I really want to keep – I wanted to keep women and I wanted to keep mental health because I thought it was really important. And I was really lucky because the first week after I became the minister, John Brogdon reached out to me, John and Lucy, and they were a wonderful support to me during that time just to have someone to hash things out. But I think too, Al, because I feel really comfortable with doctors and all healthcare professionals, I was able to seek lots of help and advice. And, you know, our suicide prevention strategy was game-changing. Like, it was so exciting to go to those, you know, what they used to call COAG meetings, but just talk about what New South Wales was doing. We were so ahead of the game on that. And Tanya Davies started a lot of that, and she was really helpful to me when I first came in as well. And you really appreciate that because sometimes in this place people are out to not want you to do as well or do something, but she did.
Sometimes your biggest critics are your predecessors in a position. So it's good to have someone that can help you.
Yeah, yes. And she was terrific. And look, I just loved being back in health. It was just fantastic. So we did lots of different things too. You know, we had that safe haven model that we rolled out, which is run by peer support workers. And that was a really big thing for me to use people with lived experience and mental health. And that was so successful that it was one of our strategies that we rolled out during the floods. And it was really successful. And just things like, you know, a group approached me about equine therapy, right, about horse therapy. And at first I was just like, because I'm science trained, I like to see evidence, I like to see data, and there was nothing there to tell me this was going to work. But it was after the fires down in Cobargo and on the south coast. And I thought, you know what, we need to give this a go. And it was those opportunities that you could have to try that. It was the most unbelievable success that, you know, and I know it seems like such a little small thing, but it was actually really important to those people. So I did try and listen, and I tried to sort of, you know, do lots of different things. I had great, I mean, I didn't always do what the stakeholders wanted, but I know they had a lot of, you know, we had a lot of mutual respect, and it was a really, it was a great 4 years.
I've got this amazing person in my electorate called Dr. Yvonne McMaster, who's this sort of amazing advocate for palliative care. You've been a great advocate of palliative care. What are some of the achievements that you feel have happened during the coalition government in palliative care?
I love Yvonne. She's so wonderful. Do you know, she even gave me time when my dad was sick and had cancer and wanted to sort of help me. She's just such a beautiful person.
Yeah, she is.
I think with palliative care, you know, Dom Perrottet was really, really, really firm on this, and it was particularly after the voluntary assisted dying legislation that if that got through, we had to have really strong, robust palliative care. And I'd spent a lot of my specialty doing palliative care nursing, so I was really passionate about it as well, and so was Brad. And so we were able to quarantine, you know, close to $500 million into palliative care services in New South Wales. And it wasn't only CapEx, it wasn't only capital expenditure, it was about investing in our workforce, investing in our doctors. And one thing that I really loved about it was it had a real focus on community-based palliative care and making sure that continuity between community-based care and acute care was really fluid. So if you had someone at home that was dying and it had been a really tumultuous time, you could actually just come into the hospital for a week and then probably bring them home the week after. But everything should be seamless. And I think I was so genuinely gutted and upset when I saw that cut in palliative care in the budget because I really expected more. And I know there's people in the
Labor. This is the Minns government's first budget that we just had. Yes.
Like, you know, of all the things.
And massive in its amount.
Yeah. And it will have a profound difference on the services that we're able to provide.
One of the things that I loved about the palliative care reforms that the coalition did was, as you said, it wasn't just capital. It was providing funds so that there could be a number of palliative care nurses in each region of the state to try. And I thought that had your fingerprints all over it, in the sense that, you know, you understand the importance of having those people locally all around the state, not just in large regional centres. Mm. So one can only assume that those cuts to the funding will have cuts to those services in regional areas.
Absolutely. And the thing is too, if there's, you know, when you have someone who's trained in your area, it's all that other stuff. It's about that younger nurse that comes in that might have just moved to the area that sees the way that, you know, Susan Jones is working and thinking, oh, I'd really love that spot. I'd love that clinical nurse consultant position in palliative care. And so that drives them for that excellence and that ambition and that then wanting to stay. And if you don't create these positions of specialty, you don't get people wanting to do them and then you miss out. Mm. But it's those educational benefits that those specialist clinicians provide to other clinicians down the chain. So it's really disappointing that, you know.
Yeah, I was surprised and I immediately thought you would be gutted.
Mm, I'm genuinely gutted.
Yeah.
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 The state of our regions, in many respects, we've seen something quite unusual in the last few years. For 100 years, the regions have been depopulating relative to the cities and getting smaller and smaller, and suddenly we've seen with COVID, we saw that reversal.
Mm.
What do we need to be doing to ensure that our regional areas realise the potential that remote working and all the rest of it has to offer?
And I think too, though, it was before COVID, because it was the coalition's investment in rural and regional New South Wales that meant that when you drive through a regional town now, you'll actually see a really good playground. So you're actually going to maybe stop and grab a coffee and have a chat and use the playground. So it's all of those investments in better hospitals and better schools. You know, you look at somewhere like Dubbo now that has, you know, a cancer centre. I mean, yes, Dubbo's a big centre, but Dubbo, Wagga, Tamworth, they're big cities now that people actually want to go and live in because they've got opportunities. You know, if you can provide good schools and you can provide good healthcare, people want to move there. But the problem was, is our BCR cases, they never stacked up because we never had the population. So it was this chicken and egg thing. And it's where, you know, I think Gladys and John worked so well together in the fact that I'm sure it was a bit tumultuous at times too, but it was like Gladys had a real affinity to the regions that Dom followed with. I mean, Dom was a hero out in regional New South Wales. Like, they just loved him, right? And they did that because they could see the investment. And now, I mean, it's not me using this language. It's all of the mayors and all of the people within the region saying the tap's been turned off federally and state to the regions. And once that happens, we suffer and it will set us back.
Well, the Albanese government cut off enormous amount of funding that had already been committed to regional New South Wales. And this budget is doing more of that. Regional travel, seniors travel cards, the apprenticeship cards and travel cards and so on. Really disappointing. And must feel quite a shock to have had 12 years of government that was trying to do things for the regions, and then suddenly we've got someone who's undoing that.
And undoing it so quickly.
Yes.
And that's what people are saying too. They can't believe how fast this is happening. And even when you look at the Department of Regional New South Wales, the whole reason of having that and basing people in the regions was that because if you go and you move to Wagga and your children then go to school in Wagga, you're going to be passionate about making sure that those schools are really good. And when you break your arm doing that try on the footy field and you have to go to the hospital, you want to make sure the hospital's really good. And they've basically completely massacred the Department of Regional New South Wales so that in 2 years it probably won't exist. So that means you don't have those people that are putting up the policy ideas and the policy suggestions and making sure that money is funded in budgets. They're not going to be living in those communities. So they don't understand them.
Yep.
They're not part of them, and they don't want to make them better. So it's catastrophic for the regions what Labor are doing. It really is.
Yeah, it's very concerning. What do you think then more broadly needs to be done to provide more housing in regional areas that will then facilitate a greater sort of move towards regional areas?
I mean, look, housing is investment, and investment often comes from private business, right? So it's about making that easier. And I think one of the great things the coalition did was freeing up Crown land. And, you know, we've got an example in Cooma, but it takes too long when it goes through council So more needs to be done about that. But it is supply and demand. And that's what worries me sometimes with Labor's policies at the moment as well. It's about, you know, whipping landlords. If we haven't got people buying those things to create the housing, then that's a real problem as well. So I think you need investment. You need to make things easier for developers. You need to make sure, in terms of, I mean in a very structured and process-driven way, but make sure that that's increased and it's a lot faster in what needs to happen. And I think there's huge potential in releasing more Crown land, which was what the coalition started.
Yeah. Well, Bronbron, Regional New South Wales is very lucky to have you as its representative here in Macquarie Street. Thanks so much for joining me on Macquarie Street Matters.
Oh, thank you, Al. You know, I love you to bits. You've been a really good friend to me in here, and I think you're such a good friend to all of us. You are our sensor check. You know, when we have a big complicated problem, it's you we come to, and you never make us feel silly. So thank you very much for having me on the very famous Macquarie Street Matters, and thanks for being such a good mate.
Thanks, Bronny. All the best. Freya, another big week in state politics. We've had a whole lot of things happening, including the attempt to censure a minister. But before I get to that, it was almost as if the sitting week finished on Thursday, and then on Friday, a number of new matters. It's almost as if the government was waiting for a number of new matters to then come forward. So the first was an attempt to try and slip through the fact that Courtney Hussos had been stripped of her responsibilities for the insurance industry because some time ago, at the end of June, the Daily Telegraph had raised the question about whether it was appropriate for Courtney Hussos to be the minister responsible for insurance when her husband was actually a lobbyist for the insurance industry. Yeah. And in fact, you know, she's the minister for finance, and that didn't have those responsibilities in the last government. So the government had actually gone out of their way through administrative arrangements to give her that responsibility, notwithstanding her husband works in the industry. And now Chris Minns, at the end of the last sitting day, the next day he just quietly, by notification in the Government Gazette, notifies that she's been stripped of those responsibilities and they've gone elsewhere. So that was an interesting, controversial thing. I mean, Chris Minns is all politics, no policy. Another example of him trying to slip something through. Then also that day, it became apparent that Cameron Murphy, an upper house Labor MP, was calling for the introduction of pill testing. So that had happened just the day before in Parliament, the last sitting day of a two-week sitting block, and Parliament isn't going to sit now until the middle of November with budget estimates and the like. So Cameron Murphy gets up. Cameron Murphy, by the way, the son of former High Court Judge Lionel Murphy, who was sensationally prosecuted for perverting the course of justice, found guilty, then there was a retrial after the conviction was quashed in the Court of Appeal, and then Lionel Murphy famously, as a former Labor senator, didn't give evidence in the retrial, gave an unsworn statement from the dock. They then had a parliamentary inquiry, which it's transpired since they've released the papers. The counsel assisting the parliamentary inquiry said that they found at least six respects in which Lionel Murphy had misled the jury in his statement from the dock. So a somewhat controversial family, but Cameron Murphy saying we should have pill testing. Now, Ryan Park, the health minister, had got up only a couple of weeks ago saying that pill testing is not a silver bullet. And of course, the reason it's not a silver bullet is for two pretty major reasons. The first is that just because I test one pill, I don't know that that is representative of the other pills that are at the concert because they're all illegally made. It's not like we're talking about Mars bars where they all come out of the same run of a factory, right? Exactly. They're all coming from different places by different people without any standards.
Different ingredients.
Exactly. So testing one pill doesn't tell you what's happening. It can give incredible false confidence. But then more importantly, the fact of the matter is that the pills react differently to different people. So you can't tell whether you're going to react to a pill that I won't react to and vice versa. So the idea of pill testing is highly controversial.
Yeah.
And yet, and which I think was recognised by the health minister saying pill testing is not a silver bullet, quite accurately, Ryan Park. But then we have Cameron Murphy. He's only been in Parliament a few months and he's already causing trouble for the government.
Gosh. Yeah, wow.
So a bit of disarray there. And then we had on the weekend the announcement that Moore Park Golf Club was going to be transformed from 18 holes to 9 holes. It's on Crown land.
Yeah.
The state government, Chris Minns, announced we're going to chop it in half. He said that we're going to create part of the 9 holes that are being chopped out are going to be turned into parkland, but then the rest is going to be turned into housing. Now, and sort of he was making statements about, you know, this is going to be the great Central Park of Sydney and all the rest of it. Of course, apparently no one had told him that there's this place called Centennial Park, which is massive and not too far away. So, you know, I mean, Chris has really got to get out more.
So silly.
So there was that. But then he went on Ben Fordham and he said two things. He was asked a question, have you discussed this, you know, with Clover Moore? Because Clover Moore's been a big advocate of this happening for many years.
Oh, right.
And Chris Minns denied talking to Clover Moore about it and then had to get his office to text 15 minutes after the interview saying, oh, yeah, he did mention it with Clover Moore in a conversation not so long ago. And then the second thing he said during the interview was that the club had been told about it on the weekend and he gave this long explanation about they were obviously unhappy and they'd advocated and so on and so forth. But that was the government's decision. And then the president of the club rang in and said, we weren't told at all by the government. We got a message that there'd be an article in the newspaper on Sunday about it. And also Golf New South Wales have also denied having been told about it. So it's a case of...
So Chris Minns made up that whole conversation.
Well, two kind of lies within a very short period of time, it would seem. So... somewhat shambolic, and the credibility of the government and the Premier are very much called into question.
Mm.
And then, of course, this has echoes of that Rose Jackson announcement where...
I think we talked about this last week. Rose Jackson, they were changing something about the percentage of runoff water from your land
this
farm.
This was some time ago,
Yeah, that was a couple of weeks ago. And Rose Jackson said she'd consulted with all of the New South Wales irrigation stakeholders. And, you know, she made a big point about all the consultation they'd done.
And as it turned out, no consultation
None of them had been consulted at all. Wow.
So what we're seeing, even with the Premier, I mean, there's this fallacy that the Premier is somehow keeping up the team, but I think the true position is that the Premier is as bad as all the rest of them. Quite extraordinary. Then we had, during the week, while we're talking about misleading people, we had a censure motion of the police minister who denied having told the Jewish leadership that they should stay out of the city at the time of that Palestinian protest on the steps of the Opera House, and also denied referring to the Jewish community as you people, right? So both in Parliament, both attributed very strongly to reliable sources. Obviously, leaders of the Jewish community don't want to go on the record having an I said, he said with a minister in the government, but informally it's quite clear what they're telling people and what they told people at the time. See, this is the point. The point is that the conversation on the Monday afternoon then had to be communicated to the community, and so what the police minister had said was, although not put in an email, certainly put, you know, told to many people in the ordinary course, as you would expect. So her denial subsequently is inconsistent with many contemporaneous accounts of that conversation to many people. So we've got a minister who's misled a parliament. But, you know, the really critical thing is that our Opera House just turned 50, which is a a moment of great celebration in our state, but there's only one time I can remember in the 50 years of the Opera House that there's ever been a political protest on the steps of the Opera House, and that was 2 weeks ago when the Palestinians protesters were chanting, you know, effectively kill Jews and setting off flares and so on. I mean, since 9/11, the peninsula of the Opera House has been one of the most secure places in Sydney. There are barricades, there are security guards, because it is a prime target, because it is one of the world's iconic buildings.
Yeah.
And the only government, the only police minister in 50 years that has ever allowed protesters on the steps of the Sydney Opera House has been the Minns government's police minister. And that is because of the complete absence of leadership. The Premier himself was on holidays on the day, and the police minister wasn't able to manage the situation. And that's why the coalition has been holding this police minister to account. It's why there was a censure motion. It's why it is unacceptable for that police minister to mislead Parliament. And it's why the opposition brought that motion. It was defeated on party lines, with the crossbench siding with the government, as it does, because those crossbenchers want to get favours for their electorate and their favourite sort of policy matters. But it was quite disappointing to see how quickly the Minns government is really, on a range of issues, misleading the public, whether it be about conversations leading to a golf course announcement or even more serious things like what is happening at the Opera House. But can I just say that when I did search whether there had been any political protests on the steps of the Opera House in the last 50 years, the closest I got was more than 50 years ago in 1966, a group of architectural students protested against Jorn Utzon being replaced as the architect on the project. And that was the closest I could find from my research as to protests on the steps of the Opera House. I think that might be a protest that we could support, because Jorn Utzon was clearly a genius who has produced one of the most beautiful buildings ever made. We are so lucky to have it as an icon of Sydney. I saw him interviewed about his philosophy in terms of the design of the building some years ago in a documentary, and he said that this was going to be a place where we wanted artists to be the best they could, humanity could be.
Yeah.
And so as a consequence, I wanted to give them a building that was befitting that standard of performance. I think he did that with spades, and happy 50th birthday to the Sydney Opera House.
Wow, Alistair, it has been a really, really busy week. My gosh.
It has. And look, as opposition should do, we're trying to bring the government to account, because that's the best way we can get good government in New South Wales.
Exactly. And it's so important that that happens, because with so many of these things, like, you know, the golf course and the pill testing backflip, all that sort of stuff, like, you don't even realise that's happening. Normal people aren't really following every single move of New South Wales Parliament. But it's so important, because this is still the government. So it's really great that we've been able to bring all these bits together and really shine a light on what's truly going on in the New South Wales government.
Because Macquarie Street does matter.
That's
and
right.
Thanks for joining us this week. I know you. You know me. I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Macquarie Street Matters, and I look forward to you joining us again next week. Together.